got KOOP Hornsby Austin. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio on a really lovely sunny winter's afternoon in Austin, Texas. It's this is volume two, number two. We kind of do it like if it was a newspaper, since Rag Radio kind of comes from the Rag, our underground newspaper in the 60s. And my guest actually was used to work for the Rag. Steve Russell, Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, is a Texas trial court judge by assignment. He recently retired as an associate professor of criminal justice at Indiana University. His writing has been published widely. He's a columnist for Indian Country Today and a contributor to the Rag Blog. Steve was an activist in Austin in the 60s and 70s and wrote for Austin's underground paper, The Rag. He lives in Sun City, Texas, near Austin. We'll discuss whatever. He has a rich and interesting life story, narrative. We can talk about a number of issues which Steve is involved in or has certainly strong opinions about. I want to tell you that Steve writes, I mentioned Steve writes for the Rag Blog. There's an article of his right now, Steve Russell on being outed as an American Indian, which was published yesterday in the Rag Blog. The Rag Blog is at theragblog.blogspot.com. Steve was a high school dropout, graduated magna cum laude from University of Texas, has a law degree from the University of Texas, a Master of Judicial Studies from the University of Nevada at Reno. I know that in a different article that you wrote that we ran in the Rag Blog, you said that that you didn't know any Native Americans, any Indians, who used the term Native American without a smirk. Are you an Indian?
Well, I was born that way. I guess now I'm whatever people choose to call me. Almost late is what they chose to call me today.
Yes, I might mention that literally Steve came in the door as our theme music was playing. He was in, he called me from I-35 a while back, and we didn't think he was making it. We were ready with some other stuff. So anyway.
Luckily, the Austin police cars I saw by the side of the road were busy with other people as I went zipping past. My fault entirely. Although I got to say, when I came in and I heard the theme song playing, it really brought back memories of the band playing in Old Palmer Auditorium, and the Rag staff was kind of in the back up in the cheap seats yelling, "Rag, Mama, Rag," you know, because we kind of looked at it in those days as our theme song.
We're going to talk about those days, too. I wanted to start out, though, talking about your growing up in Indian country. You wrote another article which was fascinating about your, that I think was originally written for Native, Indian Country Today, about your experience as a kid and your ideas about how to educate yourself, how to relate to school, and how to relate to the library.
Yeah, it was more about how school related to me. I just did not do well in the public schools. And I'm trying to make a fine distinction here, perhaps, but it's important to me. Nobody said to me, "You're Indian, you can't do anything." But there were certain things I was supposed to do and certain things I wasn't supposed to do because of who I was. And because I grew up in a small town, there was no hiding who I was. And so they were always trying to train me for things for which I was not suited. Working with my hands, reading clocks, obviously, whatever. Just whatever they wanted me to do, I couldn't do. I only remember taking one class that I brought anything away from, and that was typing. I signed up to meet.
Put that to use. Huh?
I signed up to meet girls, of course. I was the only guy in the class. But actually, it turned out to be really useful because when I got in the military and had to run a computer that had a keyboard, I actually knew where my fingers went on the keyboard, and all the other guys were hunting pecking.
You dropped out of school. You said, in fact, that when you were in school that you didn't really go to school, that you spent all your time in the library.
Yeah.
that and that you read the books in the library sort of just shelf by shelf?
Well, it was a small library. What can I say? I'd made a pretty good dent in that library, actually. That entire library in Bristow, Oklahoma, was maybe the size of your studios here. No offense, your studios aren't very big.
Hey, they're giant. They're studio size. So then you, when did you come to Austin? And why?
Well, I very, very first came to Austin way back, must have been around 65, when I was assigned to an Air Force base in San Antonio, and we took to coming to Austin whenever we could for the civilization. I think I was going through my Henry Miller period at that time, and you could not buy books by Henry Miller in San Antonio. It was not a very good place for bookstores. Austin had great bookstores, even back in those days. So I came here to get books and stayed for the education, I suppose.
How did you get involved in the movement and in the and working with the RAG?
Well, I'd been involved with the movement long before I ever came to Austin. Actually, the movement didn't really...
A term that people today might not even relate to or understand.
That's a good point. I know what you're talking about, and you know what you're talking about, but there could be listeners who
don't. But as everyone knows, the 60s were a crazy time, and there was a lot of ferment, and some of it was political and some of it was cultural.
Right, and I started out kind of on the political end of it. There were two things in particular that really politicized my way of living. One was the way black people were treated. I did not perceive the way Indians were treated as what it was, racial bias, not exactly racism, just the living and breathing stereotype. I could not handle the way blacks were treated in this little town where I grew up. So I kind of started out involving myself with the civil rights movement, meaning the black demand for equality. Of course, when you ask an Indian what the civil rights movement is about, they will tell you something entirely different. It's about the right to be different, not the right to be the same. But that was to come much, much later. I was also involved in the farm workers movement before I ever got to Austin, starting right after I got out of the service. I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for a couple of years. There was an underground newspaper up there called Kaleidoscope. A guy named John Coyce was the editor.
Knew it well.
Actually, I enjoyed that paper a whole lot. But that kind of focused my attention on the underground press. I was already focused on the farm workers movement. I was picketing stores up there. And the black movement was still very much alive and well. This is like 1968.
Of course, the farm workers movement was to a great extent, involved Hispanics, Chicanos, as we called them. So you were cutting across the lines there. So.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I didn't really recognize those lines, and you know there are very few things for which I will take credit about my life. But the one thing I will take credit for is I never bought into the race thing. Never, not for a minute. I knew it was wrong from the get-go. And I have to credit myself because there was no human being who was on my side on that deal. Not an adult, not another kid, no one. I was the only one who thought this whole classification of people by race was insane.
And that included Indians, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I also, for to some
degree, by included Indians, I mean were you in a town that was mostly Indians, or
the largest minority in the town was American Indians.
Okay.
The blacks would be second largest, and I never saw a Chicano ever. Well, that's not true. Some guys came through looking for farm work one time, and their truck broke down. But no one lived there.
Yeah.
I never met a Chicano until I came to Texas.
American Indians at that point did not have that consciousness either about
not at all, race. Not at all. Yeah. It was race that started me thinking I was weird, perhaps. Then I went in the service and volunteered to go to Vietnam, and through a long series of coincidences, got myself educated about Vietnam. And by the time I got out of the service, I was opposed to that war to the degree that, honestly, I thought we were fighting on the wrong side, which is not something I think about our current adventures. I mean, there are a lot of bad things you could say about what we're doing right now, but we're not fighting on the wrong side. We may be doing something futile, we may be doing something against our national interest, but at least we're not fighting on the wrong side. Vietnam was kind of in a class by itself.
No. And when we talked about the movement, which kind of was a point of departure for us there, the movement, of course, especially the political movement, the New Left, was
when it all came together.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It was a convergence of all of these various things that were happening.
Yeah, that brings up sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Well, you were only involved in the political end of things, though, right?
Oh no, I did the sex, the drugs, and the rock and roll. Also.
Okay, well-rounded human being.
Absolutely.
Even though the civil rights movement had informed what we were doing to a great, and I say we because I was there too, of course, what we were doing, but the Vietnam War and especially the draft kind of brought it home to everybody, right?
Yeah, when I first came to Austin, I came because of the University of Texas. I wanted to be a draft counselor at one point, and I went and took the training and was pretty much informed during the training that the government did not observe its own rules, at which point I decided I didn't want to be a draft counselor. What's the point? You know, if they're not going to follow the rules, why should we follow the rules? It's kind of an early epiphany for somebody who was going to be a lawyer later on.
You got involved then, you said you got involved then with the RAG. What was that experience like?
Oh, well, the RAG, we called ourselves the Miracle of Functioning Anarchy, and that's just exactly the way it was. I first walked in the door of the RAG because of my experience with Kaleidoscope in Milwaukee, where I had not been anyone of any importance and had not really published anything. I was just kind of a scut worker around the edges. And the RAG was different. I mean, you walk in the door, and whatever you felt like you could do, people would let you give it a shot. And I hadn't been around 6 months until I was, as we say the trade, getting bylines. And I used my real name, which not everybody did.
You were talking in the article that you just wrote for the RAG blog about being outed as an Indian, which came later, but you said also that even your friends, it sort of changed the way that your friends related to you. When you were working for the RAG, did people know you were an Indian or think that?
Well, I didn't make a big deal out of it. I think people knew because I was always grabbing articles from Underground Press Service that were coming in from Indian country, which Texas was not then and is not now. But I was always trying to slip those things into the RAG, and I kind of thought people knew, but I didn't make a big deal out of it. The only conversation I can recall that had anything to do with it was there was in Akwesane Notes, they printed a recipe for dog stew, and I wanted to put it in the RAG, and people wouldn't let me, and had a little argument about it, you know.
And well, they shouldn't.
How could you eat a dog? Dogs are your friends. Well, hell, I wouldn't eat a cow who was my friend. You know?
you discussed in this article about the effect that when did being an American Indian and people knowing that you were an American Indian start affecting the way people related to you?
Let's see, that had to be 1992 or 3. Like, I'd have to go back and find out when the American Statesman did that. And by the way, the Statesman didn't make any big deal out of it.
What was it they did?
It was just a news story. I had testified in the legislature about a bill to protect Indian graves here in Texas, something I'd been working on a long time and had not gotten any publicity about. And I was really pleased that they printed something about it, even though the reason they did it was because the other side asked them to. And they just mentioned that I had testified and that I, on behalf of the Texas Indian Bar Association. And it kind of all came floating out there, and I didn't think it was any big deal. Turned out it was a big deal.
One of the things you said was that suddenly, with everybody, that your IQ dropped 20 points. What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant lawyers who before then, even if they didn't like me, they had a lot of respect for my intellect, at least, no longer did. And some of my liberal friends really disappointed me because they had all these stereotypical ideas, like I would, maybe I'm out talking to the animals on the weekends or something. It was truly weird, the things they thought of me that they wouldn't have thought of me before. And, of course, the conservatives were all convinced that I was doing this because I wanted to, that it would help me in my political career. I'd never made any secret of the fact I wanted to run for Court of Appeals, which I never did, by the way. But it changed who I was in so many ways that I was still unraveling it at the time I quit as a judge.
We're talking with Steve Russell. This is Rag Radio. We'll be right back.
Look at us. Look at us, we are of earth and water. Look at them, it is the same. Look at us, we are suffering all these years. Look at them, they are connected. Look at us, we are in pain. Look at them, surprised at our anger. Look at us, we are surprised at our anger. Look at us, we are struggling to survive. Look at them, expecting sorrow be benign. Look at us, we are the ones called pagan. Look at them on their arrival. Look at us, we are called subversive. Look at them, descending from name callers. Look at us.
Okay, Rag Radio. My guest is Steve Russell. Steve Russell was a 60s activist, a trial court judge, a professor at the University of Indiana, a writer, and a Cherokee Indian. And so we have a lot of guests today. you said that when you first ran for judge, when you first, because you were, it was an elected position, that you ran not because you were trying to make money or whatever, but you ran because you wanted to change the world. In what way did you see becoming a public official and becoming a judge in the legal world? What did you see that you could accomplish in terms of changing the world?
Well, that goes back to how I became a lawyer. I guess my arrest record was pretty lengthy. It would probably... 1 year I got arrested 8 times when I was an undergraduate. I think that was my most active year, and one semester I got my worst grades ever. I got straight B's, did get one A because I was in jail so much.
You were in jail for political activities?
Yes. One really ironic thing, I will not say that I never violated the law, but I will say I never violated the law in the manner I was charged with violating the law.
What kind of things?
So I was never convicted of anything ever.
What kind of things were you charged with? What did you do that got you
busted? A whole bunch of cases of disorderly conduct, of failure to obey a lawful order. That would be, I would be on the street and the police would tell me to do something and I would say, you can't lawfully tell me to do that. And they'd say, fine, Bubba, tell it to the judge. So I'd wind up telling it to the judge. They got me for assault once, which was totally ridiculous. I'm trying to think what else. And mostly disorderly conduct and failure to obey a lawful order.
But in situations where there were demonstrations generally?
Yes. I only had one arrest that happened outside of a demonstration going on, and that was a case where the police had an open case that involved a big guy who had a beard, and they took my picture to the victim and said, this guy did it, right? And she said, well, maybe. And so they arrested me.
Steve Russell is a big guy and does have a beard, for your information. Those of you whose screens are off, who don't have a monitor. Okay, so...
I forgot that there was no video here.
No video on this broadcast. So you got into... You just, being a lawyer, you became a lawyer partly because of your commitment to social...
Well, in all of these cases, I was defended by lawyers who did it not for the money. I didn't have any money. They did it because they believed in what I was doing, and they believed I was getting locked up for nonsensical reasons, which was the case. And typically my defense had something to do with the First Amendment. So I'd sit there in court and I would watch these lawyers argue the First Amendment. And before long, I thought, hey, I can do this. And around that time, it became evident I was not going to be able to get a job doing what I really wanted to do, which was teach high school social studies. I could not even do my student teaching in the Austin Independent School District because they didn't allow guys with beards. And I would not cut off my beard. I'd had it since I left the Air Force because I use it to cover up a really horrible scar that I got while I was in the service and that I was on VA disability for. And covering up that scar was really important to me. And getting up in front of a classroom was to me a whole lot like going on the stage or something. And I needed that beard to hide behind. I really did. I do to this day. I mean, all three of my wives had never seen me without a beard.
These wives you have not had at the same time?
Or no.
Sequential.
That's one law I never disregarded.
Okay. Just wanted to make that clear.
One divorce, one widowing, and I'm married to the third one.
Okay. There were famously lots of bearded lawyers.
Oh, yes, including the ones who defended me. Since I couldn't even do my, I got a funny story about my student teaching. To get a degree, you had to do student teaching. And the Austin Independent School District wouldn't allow me to come on the campus. I had a beard, and I would not cut it off. Well, I told the University of Texas, all of this is true, that the reason I have the beard is to cover up a scar that I acquired while serving honorably in the United States Air Force during wartime. And if you don't let me student teach, or if you don't give me a degree because somebody's discriminating against me on account of my beard, then I'm going to have to sue you. Well, that was absolute nonsense. I was just making it up as I went along.
You were bluffing.
I was bluffing. I didn't have a dime. I didn't have a lawyer. I mean, there was
You probably didn't have a case either.
Well, actually, I probably did have a case, but that's a whole other story. What happened was they created a program just for me at the Gary Job
Corps. Bearded Studies?
At the Gary Job Corps Center in San Marcos. And they sent four of us down there to student teach at the Job Corps, which was really interesting. I mean, the only students you had there were urban black guys and rural white guys. And it was like oil and water, and they really considered it a major accomplishment if you didn't get any broken furniture. I mean, basically, if you could keep the peace, they thought you were doing fine.
No assault cases, and you were doing all right.
No assault cases, and you were doing good. They told us coming in the door, you can't give these kids anything to read. Their average reading level is third grade. And besides, they couldn't agree on anything to read, so forget about reading. We've got a great film library. All you have to do is show up and show a film and make sure there are no fights, and you'll get your A for student teaching.
Now, very typical.
Yeah.
So did you get them to read?
Well, we looked through the myself and the other guys who were sent out there. They were all guys. They wouldn't send a woman out there.
Yeah.
We looked through the film library, and it was like military propaganda films and stuff like that. It was the pickings were slim.
Yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot that somebody motivated to become a high school teacher in the 60s would care to be showing. So we had to do some reading. Well, they said they couldn't read. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to talk around one of those words you'd have to bleep here. I'll just be descriptive instead of using the word. The way I got these kids to reading was I went to a bookstore on 6th Street that I was aware of, and I asked them for their remainders. And you probably know, because you're in the book business, but people out in the boonies may not know, that it, when you have paperback books and they don't sell, they don't physically send the books back. They just rip the covers off of them, and you send the covers back, and that's how you get a refund when, if you're a bookstore owner and you haven't sold all the books. And that's how you remainder a paperback book. So I go to this bookstore on 6th Street, and I was honestly really lucky that they ripped the covers off, because if they hadn't ripped the covers off, I would have got caught. And I passed out these books that I got in this bookstore on 6th Street, and I got rid of a big old box of them the first day. They were reading like fiends. And I quickly discovered that the reason they couldn't read is because no one ever gave them anything they wanted to read. Now, I would be the first to admit that what I had given them to read was crap. Yeah, you know, it was words directed to a particular purpose, and if I thought that was as far as it was going to go, I wouldn't have accomplished anything. Yeah. But we moved from those books to, to give you an example, the one book that I could not get enough copies of, in spite of going around to bookstores and begging all my friends and so on, was a book called Black Like Me by John Howard Griffin, who was a white guy who had his had himself turned into a Negro by a dermatologist. He was a very credible black man, apparently, and then he went on a trip through the South and he wrote a journal.
Amazing book.
It is, about the things that happened to him. And to this day, I commend that book to you. You, the listeners out there, and I'll, for those of you who read it, I'll tell you one more thing. I have a friend who is of the black persuasion, and she is a professor at New York University, and she got in an argument with one of her students who was saying that Griffin was writing about the bad old days of Jim Crow, which he was, and everything has changed now.
Oh, yeah.
And the upshot of this argument was that the student, who had more money than good sense, tried to replicate what John Howard Griffin had done, and he only lasted about 3 weeks till he was wanting the process reversed and he wanted to be white again. And this happened in the 90s. So it's not that long ago. So anyway, I got these kids to reading all kinds of things. And the only time I really got in trouble, because they never did find out about the books from the bookstore on 6th Street, was I brought the Black Panther newspaper into the Job Corps, and they found it, and they had a hearing about dismissing me, and it was kind of a foregone conclusion. I was going to get dismissed, and they made the professor from the University of Texas, who was my supervisor, come down to the hearing, and they, after charging me with having brought the Black Panther newspaper into the classroom and listening to my professor apologize on my behalf and so on, they finally let me speak. And I said, well, what is your problem with having these kids read the Black Panther newspaper? I'd like to point out no one's gotten in a fight in my class, and not all the other classes can say that. And he says, well, the Black Panther Party advocates violence. So I tossed him the copy of the Black Panther newspaper that he'd been complaining about, and I said, show me where it advocates violence.
Free breakfast.
Yeah, right. Free clinic, and on and on. Now, there's all kinds of this rhetoric about power to the people and so on. And, yes, there were cartoon representations of guns. Yes, that's true. But I just challenged him, show me where they're advocating violence. And he couldn't show me, and so the upshot of the hearing was that I would agree not to bring the Black Panther Party newspaper onto the Job Corps campus again, and they would let me do the last week of my student teaching so I could finish the course and get my degree.
And by then, probably the students knew how to find it without your bringing it in.
So. Well, yeah, but they that program that started just for me ended with me. They threw the University of Texas students back out of there. I think they decided we were more trouble than we were.
You always were a troublemaker, right?
Even though we didn't break anything, honestly.
Okay, so you became a lawyer instead of being a teacher.
Yeah, I kind of decided I wanted to be Thurgood Marshall when I grew up, but that didn't work out. there really were not that many gigs for civil rights lawyers, and I graduated from law school with what I thought was a crushing debt load because my GI Bill entitlement had run out when I was an undergraduate, and so I'd borrowed a lot of money to go to law school. I realized now it was piddly, but it looked huge back then. So I had to really get a job, and I decided since I can't be a civil rights lawyer, then I'll be the next best thing. I'll be a judge. And so I ran for justice of the peace before I took the bar exam, which was kind of interesting. And had I flunked the bar exam, it would have been really interesting.
My guest last week, Jeff Jones, was the first SDSer to be president of the member of Students for Democratic Society, to be president of the student body at UT. I mean, you may have been the first SDSer to become a judge in Travis County.
I was never an SDSer, although in my
The broader community that it
right. And, one of our colleagues, I never got my FBI file, but he got his FBI file. And in his FBI file, there was a document that referred to me as a leader of SDS in Austin, which was really laughable. I had raised a stink when the SDS National Convention was supposed to be on the UT campus, and they threw them off the campus, and I thought that was outrageous. And I was really outspoken about it, but it wasn't because I was a member of SDS. It was because I favored the First Amendment.
This was a little bit later, back when I was first involved in the mid-60s, early to mid-60s, people who were involved in these various struggles generally either were members of, or SDS was the kind of umbrella for all of that. And I guess that changed after a while because the movement in Austin became larger, and it had many, there were many different...
Well, in those days, if I had to defend myself against the accusation that I was a member of SDS, I would just turn to the Port Huron Statement and say, what part of the Port Huron Statement do you disagree with?
Yeah.
Because, honestly, I didn't disagree with any of it. But
The Port Huron Statement, incidentally, was the founding statement of SDS, which was a remarkable document and remains a remarkable document. It was primarily written by Tom Hayden. And people should read it. I mean, it stands to this day.
People who are hung up in the historical caricature of SDS, which it deserved to a great degree because it did go crazy, but people who think that's all it was about should go back and read the Port Huron Statement. My problem was I didn't show up in Austin full time until 1969. And by that time, SDS had begun to devolve into factions, none of which I could really identify with, and none of which had any, to me, identifiable connection to the Port Huron Statement. So I had nothing to do with SDS, other than say they should have been allowed to meet.
Yeah. It did. It's undeniable that SDS went crazy. I think it's clinical. It was clinical. So you became a judge. Did your...
Well, no, I lost the election.
Oh, you lost that election?
Yeah. I was going to win until my enemies persuaded the student's attorney to run against me. And I was running in the area that the University of Texas was in the center of it. And there I was running against the student's attorney who'd been practicing for 10 years and... outspent me 2-1. He spent about 10 grand. I spent about 5 grand. And in all honesty, there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between us, except he had a lot of trial experience and I didn't. Like I said, I hadn't even passed the bar yet, although I had by the time the election rolled around. Yeah. But for most of the campaign, I hadn't. I guess if you had to draw a distinction between us, it would be that he was very much into consumer law on the consumer side, and he was correct on civil rights issues, and I was very much into civil rights law, and I was correct on consumer issues.
Okay, so when did
that's
you
not
become,
a big difference.
When did you become a judge?
About 2.5 years later, I was appointed to the Austin Municipal Court. And then after serving one term, I was appointed presiding judge. And then toward the end of that term, it became apparent that I was going to be fired because I had a misunderstanding with the councilman who had the most to do with my appointment. There were several aspects to the misunderstanding, but the most salient one was he called me up and said he had a traffic ticket and he was in danger of losing his driver's license. And I said, oh, that's bad. you could take defensive driving. He said, I've already done that. I said, well, you could plead not guilty. And he said, I'm guilty. And I said, well, you could slow down.
Did he want it to disappear?
He wanted it to disappear, and I was not willing to disappear it, so I was a goner. And since I knew I was a goner after that conversation, I did the only rational thing I could do. I ran for higher office. And to everyone's
shock, what office was that?
Travis County Court at Law Number 2, where Bob Perkins was at the time, but Bob wasn't running for re-election. Bob Perkins and I go back to law school and the farm workers movement and a lot of other things. I'm not the only weird judge in this town. There's me, there's Bob Perkins, there's Guy Herman, who's still a probate judge here, a judge who was plucked out of the trees at the protest on campus about the expansion of the stadium.
Yeah, a bunch of people climbed in the trees did they chain themselves to the trees? I'm trying to remember. To try to keep the university from chopping the trees down. That was in when? When was that?
Oh, that had to be, let's see, 72? I don't know.
Somewhere early 70s.
Sometime in the early 70s.
Yeah, it's an experience that would make one want to be a judge.
And Guy was one of those who actually got arrested. I was at the demonstration, and I will claim credit as being the person who got the bright idea to pick up the pieces of the trees and take them over to the main building, you know, where the tower is, and pile up trees around the university president's office. And on the way over there, we're chanting, Burnham Wood to Dunsinane, Burnham Wood to Dunsinane. And, of course, that meant something.
It's all Shakespeare. It's all Shakespeare.
Didn't mean a thing to the people we were trying to influence. Burnham Wood, what?
Okay. Well, so did when you were, and how long were you a judge? Are you still trying cases?
Last case I tried was in the year 2001, which was the year I took my full-time academic position in Indiana. I am eligible to try cases. I actually got my case assignments cut off when Governor Bush was able to appoint a new presiding judge in San Antonio, where I was teaching at the University of Texas, San Antonio. But I kept getting assignments out of Austin because they knew me up here. So now I'm back, but I don't think anyone knows me anymore, so I kind of doubt that I'm going to get a lot of assignments.
Were you a good judge?
I thought so.
Were you an activist judge, as the right-wing talks says? What is an activist judge?
You can't very well be an activist judge on a really low-level trial court, although I did.
You aren't making law there.
I did write a 16-page opinion upholding the City of Austin Gay Rights Ordinance, upholding the constitutionality of it, in a circumstance where I'd actually gotten phone calls from rather important people in Austin telling me that if I did not declare that ordinance unconstitutional, that was the end of my judicial career. Which is why I wrote a 16-page opinion and why it took me so long to do it. I was convinced I was going to lose my job over that case, so I knew that someday I was going to have to tell my son, you know, Daddy used to be a judge, but he got fired, and I wanted to be able to point at what I did to get myself fired and be proud of it. So I took a long time and wrote a 16-page opinion on why that gay rights statute was and is constitutional.
Steve Russell was a 60s activist, a judge, a professor, a writer, and is a contributor to the Rag Blog, and he's our guest today on Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. Down on the drag. Down on the Drag, reading
I like from the music this station has.
Steve Russell is our guest on Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. Steve, it's interesting because when I, one of the things I always, I like paper. I'm still an old school kind of guy, and I like to have paper. I like, you know, I like to have things in my hand. And you sent me a your resume or whatever, and I was going to print it. So I hit print, and I think it's still printing. I mean, it's about, you know, you've published a lot of stuff.
Well, I had to. I was at a Carnegie Research One university. It's Publisher Parish. I mean, you know how that is. You've been around the University of Texas, for example. Yeah. As far as the teaching goes, you should meet your classes and you should be sober. that last is probably negotiable, but you must publish.
You've written a book on tribal government, which you're not going to talk about much because you want to come back and talk about it when it
actually
comes out, right?
Yeah, it's under contract to Carolina Academic Press. It's called Sequoia Rising.
Can you tell us anything about it?
Very little that would make sense because most folks don't even understand that there are tribal governments. You know, I teach in the discipline called criminal justice, and I teach the law courses in that discipline. And I have yet to find a textbook in either undergraduate criminal law or undergraduate criminal procedure that recognizes that criminal law can come from state governments, the federal government, or tribal governments. And they just ignore it. And like the last U.S. Supreme Court decision on it was just like 3 years ago, and they once more upheld that you can be prosecuted by an Indian tribe and by the state, and that's not double jeopardy because there are separate sovereigns. Or you can be prosecuted by the federal government and by an Indian tribe, and that's not double jeopardy. And it seems to me that when you're in Indian country, you absolutely need to know this. It wouldn't kill you in Texas. There are only three little reservations left in Texas.
Steve, what do you think? One of the things we were going to talk about, and we're, you know, as always, we get so sort of excited about what we're talking about right now that we end up just keeping on.
Yes, we do digress, don't we?
We do, and that's what's fun. What do you think right now, as someone who was involved in trying to change the world in the 60s and 70s, and I guess basically you haven't changed in that regard. You basically still are very interested in what's going on in the world and in social activism, though not uncritically. What is your sense right now? How do you feel about, what do you think about the Obama administration?
Well, I can't help but be a little bit disappointed, but I'm not just crushed because I always thought the guy was a moderate, not even a liberal, let alone a radical. I'm disappointed about the way the various policy debates came down. Like in health care, single payer was off the table from the get-go, and the compromise was around what kind of public option there would be, and then that got compromised away. When we talk about climate change, the only sensible thing to do, which is a carbon tax, was off the table from the get-go, and what the argument has been about the nature of a cap-and-trade system, in spite of the fact that cap-and-trade has been a total disaster in Europe. It's just an invitation to game the system. But everyone, the right wing is allowed to say that Obama's a radical because he favors cap and trade, where cap and trade is really on the right hand of the possible solutions. Carbon tax is the left position.
Which shows you how far to the right the conversation has gone in
this
country.
Yeah, but the one thing I really do like about Obama and leads me to want to get up and cheer every time I think about it is that we have returned to fact-based reality. You can actually make arguments involving facts and involving the history of the United States, and people listen to you and they respond in kind. You know, American government started going downhill with Ronald Reagan and his idea that Government's the problem, not the solution, and all of that. But even in the Reagan administration, you could argue about facts. I remember the attempt to have ketchup declared a vegetable for purposes of the school lunch program during the Reagan administration. And, you know, you're laughing about it, but that happened. And it was shot down.
Laughing so as not to be crying, you know.
Well, yeah, but that attempt was beat back because people got up and said, well, look at the ingredients of ketchup. You've got all the sugar, you know, and it's not good for you. And putting ketchup on a sandwich has nothing to do with eating a tomato. Basically, you're able to argue facts and beat that policy back. In the Bush administration, you never could do that because they wouldn't engage about facts. They didn't care about facts.
Yeah. Well, what about, though, the role? And it seems like because there's some pretense of real change with it, and there was a lot of hope built up or a lot of perhaps false hope about the nature of change that can occur, about what a president even can do in this society, in this political system. Especially the healthcare situation, the healthcare debate, and you talked about single payer being taken off the table immediately. And speaking of facts, well, the single payer is probably the most economically sensible way to go about healthcare reform. One thing that it seems like we've seen and we've learned, and it's been brought to has a spotlight on it because of the healthcare debate, is the role that money and the role that the lobbies and the role that the big corporations still play, and that they've certainly played in the healthcare situation, and that doesn't seem to have changed. And in some ways, because of those hopes that were created, it's almost more heightened.
Well, don't forget the dysfunctionality of the United States Senate.
Well, there is that,
and we've really highlighted that. Mm-hmm. You know, with the Louisiana Purchase and the Nebraska Compromise and all this nonsense, you know, handing all this power to somebody from a swing state who may or may not know anything about the issue, it's really sad. Makes me wish old LBJ was back, you know.
Well, I
remember that SDS slogan, part of the way with LBJ.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what one wonders is that as it is highlighted that dysfunctionality, not just in the Senate, but in many ways in much of the government, what's happening now is that the right wing, again, is gaining, it seems like, gaining some strength, and the real problems aren't being addressed. I mean, do you think that the fact that we see that dysfunctionality means that now we can do something about it?
I think real problems are being addressed. I don't think Obama is able to do the big things he'd like to do. But within his first 6 months in office, he took the antitrust division out of the Commerce Department, where President Bush had placed it, and put it back in the Department of Justice where it belonged. That's a big deal. I mean, when you put antitrust enforcement in the Commerce Department, which has a mission to encourage business, that basically tells you, go, folks, we're not enforcing the antitrust laws. Yeah. And Obama just turned that around.
Yeah.
The universe of discourse is so weird on account of Fox News. Let's face it, if we had straight-ahead reporting, like in the old days when there were three networks and you didn't get a lot of reporting at the edges on either side, but now you've got Fox News, which is over the right edge of the earth with total disregard for facts, and then you got MSNBC, which is supposed to be the left, and they're kind of liberal, you know.
Yeah, yeah. They're at least much more fact-based.
They are more fact-based, and I got to admit, I'm a hopeless Rachel Maddow groupie. I love that woman. You don't get that many PhDs who both care to do that kind of thing and have a sense of humor about it. And you got to have a sense of humor about it or you'd go crazy.
What about Afghanistan? What about our foreign policy? What about in the beginning it looked like Obama was going to create a different face for the United States and the rest of the world, and to some extent he did. He at least convinced the...
He's absolutely done that.
He, yeah. But the fact of what we're doing, and especially in Afghanistan and the way we're dealing with the al-Qaeda situation, does it make sense to you?
I think Obama has managed to kick the can down the road a little bit in Afghanistan, and the key is going to be if Pakistan does not really back us up, is he going to pull the plug on this thing? Because if Pakistan is not solid, then nothing we do is going to make any difference, and it's just a case of we cannot save Afghanistan from the Afghans. It's ridiculous. But for the last 8 or 9 months, Pakistan has been pretty good, starting from the time when the Taliban attacked them. You know, when they literally got attacked on their own soil, they finally smelled the coffee, allegedly. And if they stay solid, it is possible that we could pound the leadership of al-Qaeda between Pakistan and our troops in Afghanistan. That's the theory. It's going to play out or not. It has an end game. And the question is, if it doesn't play out the way it's scripted, then will he be able to pull the plug?
The question is, how
he says he will. We'll
how
see.
Can you script anything in that part of the world? And if the lessons that Vietnam taught us, it's not real easy to get out of that kind of thing once you get into it, especially when much of what you do actually increases the opposition.
Well, you know, yeah, we'll have if we are perceived as an occupier in Afghanistan, we're done. Stick a fork in us. I'm not convinced that's the case. I know we are certainly not an occupier. We've walked away from them twice when we had the run of the country. The first time when the Soviets left, we walked away from them. Then when we kicked out the Taliban, President Bush walked away from them again. So the idea that we are in fact wanting to occupy Afghanistan is preposterous. If we wanted to occupy Afghanistan, we would have occupied Afghanistan.
Well, Charlie Wilson helped create the Taliban, and then we walked away from them without doing anything.
Yeah, you know, Charlie Wilson's absolutely right that a few million dollars spent trying to rebuild the country that was in a shambles thanks to the proxy war we fought on that soil, if we had been willing to spend that money, you and I might not be having this conversation right now.
It's 2010, we're a new decade. The last decade wasn't real wonderful.
Really bad. Let's face it. I mean, 10 years of nothing.
I mean,
10 years of backsliding.
Is it? It's been down. I've been down so long. It looks like up to me.
Literally want to go out in the streets and celebrate the election of a man who basically represents a return to fact-based reality, that tells you you've really slid. I mean, when did we get away from fact-based reality? Well, we did. We absolutely did. I mean, we had federal employees at the in the national parks talking about the days when humans and dinosaurs walked the earth together. And we had anti-AIDS programs based on abstinence. Yeah, right. You know, I mean, come on.
Steve Russell, thanks for being with us. And everybody out there, thanks for being aboard. This is RAG Radio. Next week, my guest is going to be Vince Bell, something of a legend in Texas, a singer-songwriter who has an amazing personal narrative. In 2 weeks, author Tucson Tom Miller. I want to thank Tracy Schultz, who's my engineer and my pard here. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is KOOP, Hornsby, Austin.